Okay, good morning. Yeah, and forgive me if I'm spaced out still. We're going to start on page 34. We'll do the opening prayers. And if you have the white notebook, it's all on the page with the prayer text on it. We'll start with the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha at the top of page 34. Tayata mune mune maha munaye soha. Tayata mune mune maha munaye soha. Tayata mune mune maha munaye soha. And next we will say the four immeasurables. First we'll say them in English. And while we're saying it in English, we can really think about what these thoughts and wishes are, and then we'll chant it in Tibetan, and that'll kind of underline what we've been thinking. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And the chanting Tibetan version is on the bottom of page 37. Sem chen tam che de wa dang de we kyu dang den par kyu chig du. And now we'll chant Chen Reizig's mantra 8 times and Green Tower's mantra 7 times. Excuse me. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha.
How many newbies do we have here today? People first time? Really? Okay, just a couple? All right, second time? Third time? Anyway, so my name is Don Brown. I've been around for a long time, Kadamba Center. I think that's a fair way to say it. Anyway, yeah, I've been teaching here since the sort of the very beginning, and I'm just saying this so y'all don't think I just got off the boat myself. But anyway, I have recently I was designated a what do you call it, Jill? Certified.
FPNT registered.
Yes, FPNT registered teacher. So, no. It just anyway. Blah blah blah. So you know, I don't. You know, most people here didn't go to Light of the Path, but Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who is the Grand Poobah, he has repeatedly suggested that we, whatever we do at the Kadampa Center, we always start out with that bodhicitta motivation. Most people have no idea. How many people know what bodhicitta means? I've got a few. How many people know how to generate bodhicitta? I know the meditations. Raise your hands real high. I want to see. So when you say when we say generate bodhicitta, you got no idea what that means, right? We don't know how to do that. Or generate the altruistic intention to become enlightened based on love and compassion. Duh. It kind of lands flat. It doesn't, nothing. We don't feel anything. So according to the laws of karma, those of you who are experienced, what's the single most important factor in karma when we're talking about actions and their results? What's the single most important factor?
Motivation,
intention. So, you know, we're using those words kind of interchangeably here, but the most powerful motivation for spiritual awakening is bodhicitta. Okay? So we should know how to do this. At least we should be familiar with the word and then gradually over time learn how to develop it. But there's a series of meditations. So it's always good to do this. So if you can hang on to your seat here for a few minutes, we'll do this. We'll do a meditation. It'll be a guided meditation, so it won't be hard to follow, hopefully. And I'd like for you to sit up. We're probably looking at 15 to 20 minutes of guided meditation, maybe less, maybe more. We'll see. Thank you. By the way, we've debated. Actually, that's not true. We talked about changing or adding some things to the name of Kadampa Center. I call it Kadampa Center for Hemant. Are you here? Anyway, something like training in compassion and loving kindness, because that's really what our main game is. Based on the Tibetan, on the Gelupa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. But all right, so sit up straight. If you're sitting in a chair, you don't want to be, you know, you can lean back, but you want your spine up straight. Your eyes can be closed or slightly open, and then we'll follow the breath. Put your hands in your lap or on your thighs, either one, whatever's comfortable. And your head's not down or back, it's in a chin kind of slightly tucked in, tongue at the roof of the mouth, shoulders down and back, hands in the lap, both feet on the floor, back straight, but comfortable. And it should be a position, if you're sitting cross-legged, you know, you can sit like this for hours, theoretically. So take a couple of deeper, you might say, cleansing breaths and just let go. And then just follow the breath, either the rising and falling of the abdomen or the the sensation of the breathing at the tip of the nose or the chest expanding and contracting. But we're going to do just when you breathe in, count one, breathe out two. Let's do it. And I will count the first time around, then you can do it yourself. So breathe in one, and out two, in three, out four, in five, out six, and seven, out eight, in nine, out ten. Now repeat that process again silently, and if you notice sounds outside the room, don't let your mind be this totally distracted. Just bring it back to the experience of breathing. Now, the first step in developing this bodhicitta, bodhi means awakening, citta is, these are Sanskrit word means mind, sometimes translated as awakening mind, the mind of enlightenment. It is the heart and soul of Mahayana, Tibetan Buddhism. It's the heart and soul of our practice. And It sort of translates in a longer way into this altruistic, not a sincere altruistic intention to become enlightened based on love and compassion. That's what it really means. But it's not something we can just, in the beginning, it's effortful. It takes effort to develop this because this attitude is antithetical to our natural, instinctive, self-centered attitude. So we have to really work to develop this. But later on, with practice, it can become effortless and motivate every action of body, speech, and mind. So in the beginning, we start out by developing equanimity, which is this equanimous mind that doesn't cling to friends or feel aversion to beings that we somehow find distasteful or feel indifference towards strangers. So oftentimes the way we do this is in meditation. We imagine to the left is somebody we feel attachment to, and to the right someone we feel aversion for, and in the middle is some faceless person that we might have seen in an elevator, or somebody who's driving past us on the way here today, somebody we have no connection to whatsoever, which is the vast majority of beings. And we have to look at the problems with attachment before we even have any interest in letting go of our attachment to these individuals that, you know, we label a friend or loved one or whatever. You know, attachment is a huge problem. The mind's not at peace. When we don't get what we want, when the mind doesn't get what it's attached to, it gets upset and angry and disturbed. We all know what it's like to be in a relationship that we're attached to, and then somehow it breaks down, and the suffering that comes with that. So everyone that we're attached to, this being, it could be their friend today, but it could be an enemy tomorrow. It's not a stable thing. So this attachment is, one example that sticks in my mind is, you know, our friends usually don't tell us all of our, you know, they often won't tell us our faults. That's why we call them friends, right? But they're actually the friend of our worst enemy, our egocentric, self-centered mind. So is the friend of our worst enemy really our friend? That kind of analysis. Just think about it. And then the stranger, well, that the being in the middle, that relationship, only a few kind words, and that person could be a new friend, you know, or a few careless words, and they could be our next new enemy. That relationship is also changeable. And in past lives, if we want to creatively align with that notion of past lives, then they could be, they've been in every relationship with us, family and close, in every possible relationship. Then the so-called enemy is also changeable. That person could become our new best friend. We've all had examples, probably, of people that we didn't like until we got to know them better, and then we did like them. And, you know, our enemies are people that we label as with the mind of aversion. We feel aversion toward them. They teach us what? Patience. They teach us patience. Our friends don't teach us patience. No way are we going to be happy without having cultivated patience. And they are the vehicle by which our past negative karma comes back to us. They're just this is in Shantideva's text, he says, if somebody hits you with a stick, you don't get mad at the stick, you get mad at the person. Well, in this case, when the so-called enemy does something that disturbs our mind and so forth, they're like the stick. The real source of the harm that we're experiencing is our own negative mind that created the karma for us to have this experience come back to us like a boomerang. So there are different kinds of thinking analysis that we can use to help us lighten the grip of aversion to the so-called enemy or person that we feel aversion toward, and try to see them in a more positive light, at least let go of the aversion a little bit, and then let go of the indifference that we feel toward the stranger, and let go of the attachment that we feel toward the so-called friend, and we try to develop an even-mindedness, because as we practice, our goal is to get enlightened for all sentient beings, which includes not just our friends and loved ones, but the strangers and the enemies. So we can't exclude anyone. So this is the foundation, this is the firm ground that we can build this palace of bodhicitta on. You have to have it. Think about that for just a minute. Now, most people, I'd say at least 50-50, people that come to Kadampa Center are at least open to the possibility of past and future lifetimes. You don't have to believe it. It's a process, really, for most of us. You know, it wasn't part of this culture growing up, so we didn't instinctively believe like the Tibetans and people in Buddhist countries. They just assume it's so. But we, you know, we're not necessarily like that. So I'm asking those of you who are doubters, which we all are, to at least creatively align with this possibility. And then let's think about the fact that all living beings throughout all space and time, all living beings have been like family to us in past lifetimes. We always had to have a mother and a father to be born. And each, whether we were an animal or a human or whatever form we took, we always had a mother. So we try to see that all sentient beings have been family or mother to us in past lifetimes. Our mother of this life has been our mother countless times in the past and will be again in the future. So we kind of imagine everybody in this room and everybody in Raleigh and on this planet has been like family, like our mother. We focus primarily on the mother, the seeing all sentient beings as mom. Then we turn and the next step is to remember the kindness of the mother. And hopefully you're one of those people that did have a nurturing relationship with your mother, but if not, whoever really treated you with loving kindness and respect, you want to focus on that person. But you want to, you know, if you did have a mom who was loving and kind to you, try to reflect on that, on the sacrifices that she made, not only caring you for 9 months and the struggle in that, but then, you know, birthing you, feeding you, cleaning your poopy diapers, getting up at all hours of the night, sacrificing her life in a sense, putting her life, her desires anyway, on hold so that she could keep you alive. And without your mom, whether you had a good or bad relationship with her, without her you wouldn't have lived, you know, you'd be dead in 24 hours. That's a really important relationship. So try to remember, reflect on the kindness of your mom of this life, and then you extrapolate that out to all of these other sentient beings who've been your mother in past lifetimes. So that's everyone. And it's said that if you do this meditation well, and this is a hard one to do, if you do it well, no matter who you see walking along the street, not only do you feel immediate connection, but warmth. You feel warmth toward whoever it is walking, even strangers walking down the street. And the next step is the wish to repay the kindness of all mother sentient beings. So it's not somebody else's job. When somebody does something kind for you, it's your responsibility to repay that kindness. So we vow to repay the kindness of all of our kind mother sentient beings. And the next step is to see the equality of self and others. Like, and the Dalai Lama does, the way he says he does is he imagines himself, this lion, and he's on one side of the lion, and on the other side are countless sentient beings. We usually think of other as singular, but it's actually countless beings. And he says, what do I want? I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. And then countless sentient beings, they all want the same thing. I want to be happy. I don't want to suffer. Exactly the same. We want exactly the same. We're equal in this really important way. Is the happiness of one more important than the happiness of infinite others? So we're all equal in wanting happiness and not wanting to suffer. You look into the eyes of your children, your loved ones, the people in this room, the strangers on the elevator, and people driving down the highway, and wherever you are, we know something very intimate about every one of these beings. They want exactly what we want, going about it in different ways. Be happy, not suffer. Want to be happy, don't want to suffer. Don't want to be unhappy. I want peace, I don't want to suffer. So we're all equal that way. And then the biggest fault, the next step is meditating on the shortcomings of the self-cherishing, selfish mind. And if we look at the source of all, you know, in Buddhism, we're very clear that our happiness and misery is a function of our mind. How our mind not only interprets things, but our mind is constantly creating our reality. It's much deeper than just, you know, a decision to like or not like this or that. It's much bigger than that. But the source, from the Buddhist perspective, the source of all of our suffering and the suffering in this world, from individuals to entire countries and the planet in general and beyond, the suffering is the cause of one demonic force, the devil, the real devil resides in our heart in the form of selfish, self-cherishing attitude. How is that so? Well, look at it. Look at all the... If we look at just the 10 non-virtues, the ones of body and speech anyway, killing, stealing, adultery, all of those are the product of a selfish, self-cherishing mind. Lying, slander, harsh, frivolous talk, all of that comes from selfish, self-cherishing mind. Greed, hatred, ignorance, and then 84,000 delusions. There's a lot of them. All of them come from this selfish mind. So it's our biggest enemy, and we think it protects us. We think, oh, I've got to look after me. We think our self-cherishing mind is our friend. It is not our friend. Our friend is the mind that cherishes others. It's the opposite. Goes completely against our instinctive survival, and also just our the delusion of a separate self. Goes against that. So cherishing others is the source of all happiness. As Lama's Opus Bumpa Sticker says, for happiness, cherish others. Real simple. And if we cherish others, we don't kill them, we don't steal from them, we don't cheat on them, we don't lie, we don't badmouth them and slander them, speak harshly to them, waste their time with frivolous talk, hatred, you know, clinging, ignorance. All these negative mental states even are in some way opposed by the mind that cherishes others. You can feel the energy of self-cherishing selfishness is kind of like a rock in the heart. The energy is very kind of sucky, and the energy of cherishing others is goes out. It's the opposite. It's antithetical to ignorance, which is holding on to the sense of I as the most important thing in the universe, and we cling to this false sense of I. And the next step is to exchange selfish, self-cherishing with cherishing others. And that doesn't mean that you become me. It means we're exchanging the attitude. We're changing the attitude of selfishness and self-cherishing for an attitude of cherishing others. So we woke up this morning definitely, probably, if you were like me, self-cherishing. Okay? But for the moment, we're going to try on my new attitude is everything I do, say, and think is based on this cherishing others notion. So we're going to eat lunch today so we can keep our body healthy so we can benefit others. We're going to drive carefully because we cherish others. We don't want to hurt anybody. We get up in the morning tomorrow and clean up and try to look, you know, whatever, to go to work for others. Everything we do is for others. Instead of focusing on me, me, I, it's we dedicate our life to others. Lama Yeshe, who's the founder of the FPMT, I met him the last time I got to talk to him one-on-one. He was leaving the audience I had with him, and he said, I don't have much realization, but he said, as much as I can, I dedicate my life to others. As much as I can, I dedicate my life to others. And the next step, which we're not going to take much time on, but it's It's called Tongnan. If we had time to do it, we would, but we're not going to spend a lot of time. But it's a powerful meditation where we imagine that we're, and it cultivates loving kindness and compassion, the subject we're going to go into today. But basically, you imagine the suffering. Start out with yourself, maybe when you were a little boy or girl, at a time when you can remember you were struggling, and you imagine that you're suffering, and your angst, you know, sort of rises above you in the form of black smoke or black light, and then you breathe, you slowly breathe. It doesn't have to be in one breath, it can be in several breaths. You breathe that suffering into your heart, and it destroys self-cherishing selfishness. Your body's full of light, and then gradually you breathe out this light to yourself, giving you happiness. You know, it's the light of loving kindness and compassion. So we, you know, take taking on the suffering of others is a way to develop compassion, and giving others happiness and its causes is a way to develop loving kindness. So it's called Tonglen, or taking and giving. Taking on the suffering of others, giving them happiness, what they want and need, temporal and ultimate happiness. Kind of reminds me of Jesus on the cross, you know. I'm taking on the suffering of the world, and I'm giving back everlasting life. I kind of think that that's what he was trying to teach, Tonglen, taking and giving. Then the next step is called the supreme wish. It's lots of different names for it, but it's an attitude of a bodhisattva. It's an attitude that says, I am personally, and this sounds crazy when you say it, but it's an attitude that we want to develop. If it's not something that will, even if we have this attitude, it mainly benefits our mind. It's, I'm personally responsible for the happiness of all sentient beings. And I'm going to, wherever they are, I'm going to help them, no matter where they, and whatever their situation is now, I'm going to help them become enlightened. I'm going to guide them from their current state of suffering all the way to enlightenment. That's what I'm going to, and I'm going to do it myself alone. I'm not leaving it up to Geshe Gelug or the Dalai Lama or Lama Zopa or anybody else. It's my job. I'm personally responsible for the happiness of universal living beings. It's an attitude of universal responsibility. And it's based not on sentimentality or some kind of megalomaniacal, you know, declaration. It's based on sincere love and compassion for all of our kind mother sentient beings, universal living beings. We feel connected, we want them to be free from suffering. So it's based on that sincere attitude, and that's the key to making this statement. I'm personally responsible for the happiness of all beings, guiding them to supreme enlightenment. And then the last step is recognizing that we don't even have the ability to do it ourselves. We're not enlightened yet. The only being that can truly guide others sort of to the top of the mountain is somebody who's already been there themselves. So a Buddha, a fully enlightened Buddha, and someone who's eliminated, what's a Buddha? A Buddha is someone who's trained many times over countless lifetimes, but possible to even be a Buddha in this lifetime with enough effort. and good karma, someone who has trained and can guide others from whatever their current mental state is all the way to supreme enlightenment. And we can't do that. So our goal, our motivation, our intention is to become enlightened in order to be a perfect guide to all sentient beings based on loving kindness and compassion. I must become enlightened in order to guide all beings to that supreme state. I must practice, you know, renunciation, bodhicitta, emptiness. I must practice tantra, generation and completion stage. I have to keep my vows. I have to make some effort every day to develop my mind slowly, slowly. And we're out of time. No, just kidding. Well, it would be okay if we were. Jill wrote something on the board. This is from a famous text. Today the subject is compassion. Now, somebody who doesn't come to the Buddhist Center regularly, or even if you do, give me some definitions of compassion. Let me hear two or three. What is it? Don't look at that. What is compassion? Hello? Over here. We got a name. We got a volunteer. That's okay.
Empathy is what I picture.
Pardon?
Empathy is what I picture.
Empathy. Okay, perfect. He's a plant. All right, what else? Anybody got another one? All right, here we go.
I think of it as a feeling of caring for other people's suffering.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
When you're concerned about the real person, the inner person, rather than that, I think that a sense of compassion is when you're concerned about the real person, the eternal inner person, rather than the person's external circumstances. So we might mm-hmm. be concerned about a person's external life, and it's important to really care about the transcendental growth of someone on the inside. You care about that aspect of their life.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. So this is, I cannot read Jeffrey Hopkins. I'm sorry. But he says there are three kinds of compassion. Homage to compassion for migrators. That's us, migrating from lifetime to lifetime. So he says, who are powerless, like a bucket traveling in a well. So this is the first kind of compassion, because we, you know, from lifetime to lifetime, again, this presupposes you have some belief in that. But even from day to day, forget about lifetime to lifetime, we're all over the place, aren't we? One day we're up, one day we're down. One lifetime, things are going great. The next lifetime, you know, we're in the lower realms, and the bucket's clanging against the walls of the well, you know, getting beat up as it goes up and down, but never quite getting out of samsara, which is what we, this cycle of uncontrolled causation of death and rebirth. So he's saying we're powerless like a bucket traveling in a well, though initially hearing to a self, an I, and then generating attachment to things. So this has to do with emptiness, that we naturally, instinctively, and it's just part of who we are. I mean, we babies are born this way, aren't they? I mean, first thing they go for is the breast. They would give me some food. You know, I'm hungry. And then you know, anybody who's been around children knows that they're pretty self. Compassion's not on their radar right now. Let's put it that way. Thinking about others. It's really about me, I. And that's how we are even as adults, although we socially don't want to, we try to, you know, make it look good. But, yeah. So what happens is ignorance, and we all have it. Right now you can say, well, my body is sitting and my mind is thinking. Like, well, where is this separate I? My body is thinking, my mind is thinking. Like there's some separate I that exists, but we can't find that I. That I is the projection of ignorance. That's the I that ignorance not only projects, but then believes in and clings to. We call it self-grasping I. So if you say something mean to me, what do? I get pissed off. If I see something that is attractive to me, I want it, right? So I, not that we don't exist, we clearly exist, right, as a mind and body. But then ignorance projects an embellished sense of I and creates all the problems that we've ever experienced throughout all space and time. So, again, you don't have to believe it. Just check up. This is Lama Yeshe used to say, just check it up, dear. And check it out and see. You'll notice behind every negative, destructive, harmful mental state is a sense of I. And in Buddhism we say when we start looking for that I, we find out that we're empty of that I. We look for it and we can't find it. What is that book you open up and you try to find the guy? What's his name?
Where's Walden?
Huh?
Where's Waldo?
Waldo, yes. I was actually doing that last night. I didn't know what the name of the book was with my daughter. And we were looking for Waldo. And we couldn't find Waldo. On one page, we looked and we looked and we looked and we looked and looked. I went, well, this is a great teaching on emptiness. It's the same way. You can't find that I when you look for it. It's a projection of the mind. We actually did find Waldo. I did, after about 20 minutes. So you know, that's the cause of attachment, right? The more we attach to something, what? What happens? Well, is the mind at peace when it's clinging? No. When we don't have what we want, are we happy? No. When we get the opposite of what we want, what's happening? We're experiencing suffering, right? When we lose what we're attached to, suffering happens. So attachment is usually, you know, ding, that's the one that causes the biggest problems for us. Because it creates a lot of problems for us. So it says, and then generating attachment to things. This is mine, right? Homage to compassion for migrators, seen as evanescent and empty of inherent existence, like a moon in rippling water. So we're all qualified by impermanence. We're not the same people we were a moment ago. Our mind and body are in a constant state of flux. There's subtle impermanence, which is, if you sit down and meditate, you know, no matter what mental states come up, whether it be bliss or anger or fear or happiness or whatever, it doesn't last, does it? It's always in a state of flux. It's always in a state of flux. And we don't like that. We don't like that. That causes enormous suffering, because eventually, on a gross level, we get older, we get sick, and then we die. We have to lose the thing that we cherish the most, which is us. We're not ready for that. You go, I don't want to think about it. But we have to think about it, because it's part of our reality. And it's possible to be prepared for that and not freak out. But on a subtle level, it's happening all the time. All the time. I met this monk in Thailand many years ago. He had been in he was at a Thai monastery in northeast Thailand. He'd been in a retreat for like, 5 years, 4 years, something like that, in a kuti, which is this little thing on stilts, I guess, so that the tigers and the cobras can't get you. Ha! Huh. But anyway, he was on this, and there was nothing in it except, it was just and they had a tent over it, so he couldn't see out, but the air could get in. It was raised up above. So anyway, he spent a lot of years in meditation. And I asked him when he was out of the retreat, and I asked him, what was the big thing you learned, the big take-home message, and the most helpful thing? He said, impermanence. Meditating on impermanence. That nothing lasts. Everything, our body, everything that we have, everything, your loved ones, your cars, your houses, everything is going to disappear eventually. So we have to, that's just part of our reality. It's not negative, is it? Just reality. We need to know that. Okay? So, and it's possible to live our life in tune with reality, or we can be in resistance to it. Right? So, I have two things. I hate to do this, but Geshe Gelug is not going to pull out Scientific American. I can promise you that. He might, but he usually won't. There's some articles in here, but from my friend over here who was talking about empathy. So this is an article from, I sent this to several friends. I don't usually do much with Facebook, but I did send it out. It's called The Perils of Empathy. The politics and policy, trying to feel the pain of others is a bad idea. Empathy distorts our reasoning and makes us biased, tribal, and often cruel. Whoa. Hang on to your seats. So anyway, first, I'll just read the first paragraph. I'm going to read a little bit here, so hang with me. Everywhere you turn in American politics, leaders talk about the need for empathy. The best known instance, of course, comes from Bill Clinton, who told an AIDS activist in 1992, "I feel your pain." But it's also a recurrent theme in the career of Barack Obama, who declared in 2007, while still a senator, "The biggest deficit that we have in our society and in the world right now is an empathy deficit." It isn't just a liberal reflex. A few months ago, George W. Bush spoke at a memorial service in Dallas for 5 slain police officers and said, "At our best, we practice empathy, imagining ourselves in the lives and circumstances of others." As a candidate, even Donald Trump asked Americans to identify with the suffering of others, from displaced Rust Belt factory workers to victims of crime by undocumented immigrants, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So, then he goes on. This article was in the Wall Street Journal, December 2nd, 2016, if you have any interest in seeing it. But I'm going to fast forward to the last part of it. And by the way, I'm not asking anybody to believe this, but I've got some evidence here. Just want to throw it out. Given all these problems with empathy, it's a good thing that we can use rational deliberation to override its pull. Most people would agree on reflection that these empathy-driven judgments are mistaken. One person is not worth more than eight. We shouldn't stop a vaccine program because of a single sick child if stopping it would lead to the death of dozens. We can appreciate that any important decision about criminal justice, diversity policies in higher education, gun control, or immigration will inevitably have winners and losers. So one can always find someone to empathize with on either side of the issue. What about our motivation to be good people? If we don't empathize with others, don't feel their pain, why would we care enough to help them? If the alternative to empathy is apathy, then perhaps we should stick with it, regardless of its flaws. Fortunately, empathy isn't the only force motivating us to do good. Empathy can be clearly distinguished from concern or compassion. So hear this. Empathy can be clearly distinguished from concern or compassion. Caring about others, valuing their fates. The distinction is nicely summarized by neuroscientists, blah, 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 in 2014 article in the Journal of Biology. In contrast to empathy, this is what they said, quote, compassion does not mean sharing the suffering of the other. Rather, it is characterized by feelings of warmth, concern, and care for the other, as well as a strong motivation to improve the other's well-being. Compassion is feeling for, not feeling with the other. I'll read the rest of this in just a second, but in probably 1996 or 7, Geshe Dunya was here. He was a great teacher, he'd been living in Madison, Wisconsin for many years. He was a Geshe, and I remember asking him this question that wouldn't compassion make you sad, Geshe-la? Wouldn't it make you sad? And, I mean, thinking about others suffering and so on. And he said, if you're generating a heavy, sad mind when you're thinking of others suffering, that's not compassion. He said, compassion makes you happier and happier and happier. So we really have to distinguish between these two. All right. In a series of studies that I conducted at Yale University with a couple of people, just published in Journal of Emotion, we compared the people's scores on two different scales, one measuring emotional empathy and another measuring compassion. As predicted, we found that the scales tap different aspects of our nature. You can be high in one and low in another. We found as well that compassion predicts charitable donations, but empathy does not. There is also a body of research led by Tanya Singer in which people were trained to experience either empathy or compassion. Now I'll go over this. This is what's in Scientific American. The empathy training, people were instructed to try to feel what suffering people were feeling. In compassion training, sometimes called loving kindness meditation, they were told to direct warm thoughts toward others, but they were not to feel empathy, only positive feelings. The brains were scanned while they did this. It turned out that there was a neural difference in the two cases. Empathy training led to an increased activation of the insula and cingulate cortex, the same part of the brains that would be active if you were empathizing with the pain of someone you care about. Compassion training led to activation of other parts of the brain, such as the ventral striatum, which is involved in, among other things, reward and motivation. These studies also reveal practical differences between empathy and compassion. Empathy was difficult and unpleasant. It wore people out. This is consistent with other findings suggesting that vicarious suffering not only leads to bad decision making, but also causes burnout and withdrawal. Compassion training, by contrast, led to better feelings on the part of the meditator and kinder behavior toward others. It has all the benefits of empathy and few of the costs. These results connect nicely with a recent conclusion by Paul Condon and his colleagues published in the Journal of Psychological Sciences 2013, who found that being trained in meditation makes people kinder to others and more willing to help compared to a control condition in which people were trained in other cognitive skills. They argue that meditation reduces activation of brain networks associated with stimulating the feeling of people in distress in favor of networks associated with feelings of social affiliation. Limiting the impact of empathy actually makes it easier to be kind. They go on in this other article, I may get to it. It talks about empathy burnout. Empathy is the main cause of burnout in the medical profession, which right now is at 60%. 60% of people who work in the medical profession are burned out, and they think that this empathy, they call it empathy burnout. He goes on to say, I don't deny the lure of empathy. It's often irresistible to try to feel the world as others feel it, to vicariously experience their suffering, to listen to our hearts. It really does seem like a gift, one that enhances the life of the giver. The alternative, careful reasoning mixed with a more distant compassion, seems cold and unfeeling. The main thing to be said in its favor is that it makes the world a better place. So, compassion. And then somebody's written a book. I wish I could find the name of it. Anyway, the book is like it's about. Going to find it. The book is about this subject of compassion and empathy, and it's talking about the shortcomings of empathy and the upside of compassion. Now, here's some more data, because I'm not going to say I'm a scientist, but I am, you know, my daytime job, I'm a family doctor, but I read this stuff. And it interests me that there, for example, meditation lengthens your telomeres. Anybody know what telomeres are? The shorter your telomeres, the quicker you age. And meditation can lengthen your telomeres and forestall some of the things that go along with aging. All right, so these two guys, there was a guy named Matthew Ricard and David Richardson. Matthew Ricard is a monk. I think he has some degree in physics or neurophysics or something like that. And Peter Davidson works at the University of Wisconsin. And they've done a lot of work on the brains of meditators. They're using PET scans and all this kind of stuff. And I'm not going to go into all of this, but we'll touch on some of it. So to generate a compassionate state, they sometimes entail the meditator feeling that what another person is feeling. But having one's emotions resonate empathetically with the feelings of another person does not by itself suffice to yield a compassionate mindset. The meditation must also be driven by an unselfish desire to help someone who's suffering. So empathy, we can say, is feeling with. But compassion, we define compassion in Buddhism is the wish that others be free of suffering and its causes. The wish that you could be free of suffering and its causes. So it's not necessarily feeling with it, but there's an action component to it. So the meditation must also be driven by an unselfish desire to help someone who's suffering. This form of meditation on love and compassion has proved to be more than just a spiritual exercise. It has shown potential to benefit healthcare workers, teachers, and others who run the risk of emotional burnout linked to the stress experienced from deeply empathetic reaction to another person's plight. The meditator begins by focusing on an unconditional feeling of benevolence and love for others and is accompanied by silent repetition of a phrase conveying intent, such as, may all beings find happiness and the causes of happiness and be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. So remember the four immeasurables? May all beings have happiness. And the first one is, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. That's called great love. And may all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering is called great compassion. Okay? So then, fast forward down to the next section. It says, to further explore the mechanism of empathy, well, let me read this sentence. In the latter case, the mother... Talking about a mother who's okay, I better read this paragraph. According to Buddhist contemplative tradition from which this practice is derived, compassion, far from leading to distress and discouragement, reinforces our inner balance, strength of mind, and courageous determination to help those who suffer. If a child is hospitalized, the presence of a loving mother at his side, holding his hand and comforting him with tender words, will no doubt do that child more good than the anxiety of a mother overwhelmed by empathetic distress, unable to bear the sight of her sick child, paces back and forth in the hallway. In the latter case, the mother may end up with the common experience of burnout, which in one U.S. study beset about 60% of 600 caregivers surveyed. By the way, I don't think she's here today. There's one lady who's been coming to Discovering Buddhism. She worked 28 years in the NICU, neonatal intensive care unit, and she corroborated this when we read this in the class. She said, this is right on the money. She said, I have seen this so many times that amongst burnout and caregivers and burnout in the family. Then it says, to further explore the mechanism of empathy and compassion, these two investigators divided about 60 volunteers into two groups. One meditated on love and compassion, the other experimental regimen trained participants to cultivate feelings of empathy for others. Preliminary results showed that after a week of meditation-based loving kindness and compassion, novice subjects watched video clips showing suffering people with a more positive and benevolent feelings. The other subjects, who devoted a week to experimental regimen that just cultivated empathy, experienced emotions that resonated deeply with others' suffering. But these emotions also brought about negative feelings and thoughts, and this group experienced more distress, sometimes to the point of not being able to control their emotions. Last paragraph. Aware of these destabilizing effects, Singer and Klemecki added training for the empathy group in compassion and loving kindness meditation. They then observed that this additional exercise counterbalanced the detrimental effects of training in empathy alone. Negative emotions diminished and positive emotions increased. These results were accompanied by corresponding changes in the areas of the brain networks associated with compassion. Positive emotions and maternal love, including the orbital frontal cortex, the ventral striatum, and the anterior cingulate cortex. Researchers, moreover, were able to demonstrate that a week of training in compassion increases pro-social behavior and a virtual game specially devoted to measure the capacity to help others, blah, blah, blah. So that's the science. That's the science behind some of the what we, you know, what we strive to do here, which I think is cool, is to train ourselves in compassion and loving kindness. And I talked to somebody who's from Madison, and they've also shown, I read this too, that the brain, particularly the frontal cortex, actually increases in size in meditators. Okay? Maybe you've read this? Well, Richard Davison from, you know, this is their next big study. They want to see if we can diminish, avert, or even avert Alzheimer's disease with meditation. Because by what naturally happens to the brain, we call it, you know, when we do CAT scans of elderly people, the brain is shrunk. That's just normal. The radiologist says, oh, the brain is shrunk, normal for age. Like somehow when you're 80 years old, your brain's supposed to shrink. Well, dementia is not normal. Now, as we age, what is normal is that the computer slows down. It takes longer to retrieve information. But you can still teach old dogs new tricks. So that's not part of the normal aging process. Yet we've almost gotten to the point where we think it is, and it's not. So meditation, particularly on meditation on loving kindness and compassion, and mindfulness practice can actually, you know, cause the brain to grow and maybe avert some of these problems that go along with aging. So now we have 4 minutes for questions. Yeah.
So back to the meditation process, one of those central steps was to take in the darkness of others and almost act as a filter and create that light and then project that out.
Right.
So my question is, all filters need to be changed after a while. So how do you go through that process of not absorbing the darkness or changing the filter?
That's a great question. I've heard that one before, and several times, and I'll give you some answers. Somebody asked a Tibetan Lama one time when they walked through a hospital, and they would, as best I can remember, anyway, they asked him that question. He said, well, what if I'm imagining taking on the suffering of somebody with cancer, and I get the cancer, but they get freed, they get cured. And he said, fantastic. Your meditation's working. That doesn't work for most of us. We don't want it. So this is an attitude that we're trying to develop. But I know if you're worried about this, the point of taking on the suffering, if you remember the meditation, and you start out with yourself, okay, then you can expand it to your loved ones and then to people that you then maybe everybody in the world with AIDS and all the people that are struggling with, political problems or whatever, even Donald Trump, we could work with him. That's a whole day's practice right there. But taking on the suffering and wishing them happiness and the causes of happiness. So, we take on the suffering and we imagine it as black smoke and it comes in, but then it goes down to the heart and it explodes. So it doesn't stay and it destroys the self-cherishing I at the heart. I didn't go into that much detail about it, but it destroys the self-cherishing I that's like a black rock keeping us, around our heart. It destroys that, and then our bodies fill with light, the light of loving kindness, okay? And we send out, may you be happy and have the causes of happiness. May you be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Explode self-cherishing. May you have happiness and the causes of happiness. So we breathe in the suffering, breathe out happiness and the causes of happiness.
So it's almost as if we're absorbing a negative with our own negative and therefore converting it into a positive.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any last minute questions? A lot to absorb. Yeah, in the back. By the way, one of the things in Buddhism that I like when I first was introduced to it was you don't have to believe anything in Buddhism. You know, the point is to check it up with your own experience. So if you have some resistance to this, it's okay. You could do your own research. You know, Lama Yeshe used to say, the Buddha's already done his job. He's done his research. Now it's up to us to prove that the Dharma is true or not true. And if it's not true for you, if this doesn't work for you, there's another trip down the road, and you're welcome to go. You're welcome to, you know, it's like we're not pushing anything on anybody. We're like an invitation. We're giving people information that we think could be helpful for certain individuals. And so we're inviting you to do your own research and see if it works. Yeah. Go ahead.
I guess I was still a little confused about the compassion versus the empathy piece. We, at the school that I work for, we have part of our leadership model is displaying empathy for one another and for the children. That's actually part of the language that we use with them.
Right.
I do feel like that is a muscle that can be built and stretched. And we talk a little bit about the differences between compassion and empathy. By the way, that magazine that you're reading from, it's the only one that I kept from that series. So I'm really excited to go back. I recognize the orange cover. Yeah.
Scientific American, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm excited to go back and read it. But, you know, one of the things that we had watched this video where there was this person that was really just devastated and they'd climbed down into a hole. Actually, it was an animation. They were an animal in the animation. They climbed down into the hole. And they were saying, my husband has left me. You know, I have an illness. One of my children is not doing well in school. And there was this other little person who climbed just to the very tip of the hole and looked down at them and said, it's a beautiful day outside. At least you still have your legs. And so at the same time, when we talk about compassion versus empathy, while that might be positive, and maybe it feels good for the person who's saying it, I really wonder how much it is effective or helping the person who is in the hole. We kind of switched to a different video, and we saw that same little person disguised as an animal coming all the way down into the hole with that person whose husband had left them, who had an illness and whose children weren't doing well in school, and reached out and said, I'm so sorry to hear this. I'm so sorry for your pain. Can I give you a hug? Mm-hmm. And they embraced each other in the hole together. So, and we talked about, you know, the compassion being the person who's at the tip yelling down, hey, come on out and have some ice cream. I wish you well. It's gorgeous out. And the empathy being the person who actually walked down into the hole and experienced what that person was experiencing and reached out and gave them a genuine hug. So I guess I'm still a little stuck on the differences between the compassion and the empathy piece.
Right.
Just my perspective.
Yeah. Anybody want to respond to that?
I think that the people who went to the edge of the hole and said, it's a beautiful day, at least you have your legs, that's not compassion.
No.
So that's the crux of the difference.
Yeah. Also, you can compassion should, again, you know, conjoined. It is a mind state, but the important thing is that, you know, it needs to be followed by action when appropriate. But I didn't go into this, but I'm going to say it really quickly. There is something called compassion has to be has to be balanced with wisdom in Tibetan Buddhism. Those are the two arms of the bird of enlightenment. And there was a Jataka tale at the children's camp this a couple of weeks ago where there were three monkeys who saved three fish from drowning. Right? They went out and grabbed the fish and threw them on the ground. Are we going to help these fish? Look, they're in the water. They're drowning. And their mother said, no. Put them back in the water. You got to have wisdom and compassion together. The term idiot compassion came out some years ago. So we have to have both. And the person standing over the hole looking down, they might have had some compassion, but there's no wisdom. The wisdom would have sent them down into the hole to get them to help that person. Yeah.
Well, as I try to internalize and synthesize the differences between empathy and compassion, I picture that compassion is the thought and active giving of yourself, and empathy maybe you trying to take from the other individual. And in my own impression and in my own reality is that we cannot take from individuals. We cannot compel emotion and thought and action and change in individuals. We can only give of ourselves in action and in positive intention in order to encourage positive outcomes. And so as I'm trying to internalize and synthesize those differences, I think that I do like compassion more than empathy, and that compassion focuses on me and my giving towards some sort of positive outcome.
Thank you. Well, we're going to have to call a halt to it, but you know what? I thank you for the sharing, everybody, and the questions. And I think it is an area that, honestly, most of us. I used to define compassion as empathy myself until I read this article, and then I had to start rethinking about it. And now I have a little bit different attitude. I think it's bigger than that. And it's something that we all need to, I'm inviting us all to kind of take another look at what we mean by compassion and what we mean by empathy. And when we're suffering, when we see our children struggling, I think it's more empathy than it is compassion. I've been going through that recently. So anyway, we all have our experiences. So let's do, we say, there have been lots of seeds planted today. We want these seeds to ripen in the garden of enlightenment, not necessarily in just worldly happiness or a new, the next life being a little better, but we'd like for it to ripen in a way that increases our ability to help others and to help ourselves. So can we do the dedication verses, Donna?
So the dedication verses are on page 246 of the Gold Prayer Book. And again, let's read this kind of slowly today and really relish the words that we're saying and think about what it means. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merit. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world.
Okay, thank you. No announcement. We have one or two announcements. We used to have 15 minutes of announcements, but now.
So, hello. My name is Joy Gooch, the garden manager. In the next month, close to the end of October, we're going to have a bulb planting day. And usually what we do is we dig holes, and then we plant bulbs with the kids so that they can be an active part in it. And we're looking for donations for bulbs, so stuff like crocuses, hyacinths, and irises that are Siberian irises, or either what's the other one, Donna? The little Dutch irises, but not the bearded iris. We got plenty of those. As a matter of fact, we may be asking you to take some with you if you want some bearded irises. But if you can help us with a donation of some bulbs so we can plant them. Daffodils too, yes. So if you could make a donation, we greatly appreciate it, and that way we can have a lot of bulbs for the kids to plant. And if you'd like to join along, plant some bulbs too, we appreciate that too.